Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
And welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, Gina Glass will be telling us a little bit about Dreamsicle Kids. So, can you tell me a little bit about the foundation?
Sure. Dreamsicle Kids Foundation is the first sickle cell organization in Nevada. Our focus is raising sickle cell awareness in the state and advocating for sickle cell patients to address the health disparities that are experienced by them. Recently, we also expanded to include all rare diseases in our support. So we advocate for all of the over 7,000 rare diseases that are out there. We offer support, financial support, referral services. I'm a certified community health worker, so anybody in need of community health services, social services that I can assist them with, we provide that also. Transportation services, advocacy services, and we kind of spearheaded the passing of the first sickle cell bill here in the state of Nevada in 2019.
So, for those who might not be as familiar with how sickle cell impacts a person, could you tell me a little about that?
Sure. So, sickle cell disease is a genetic red blood cell disorder. So, normal red blood cells are round in shape. And people who are affected with sickle cell, their blood cells are shaped like a banana or sickle, which is where the word derived from. So being that their blood cells are irregularly shaped, it makes it hard for them to pass through the blood vessels. So they get clogged sometimes and cause a person with the disease to have severe pain. It also weakens their immune system. Because the blood can't properly flow through to their organs, they have organ failure. The oxygen doesn't pass all the time properly through their body, so that causes them to experience the pain and have the compromised immune system, makes them more susceptible to pneumonia, which can turn into what's called acute chest. Which is when you begin to have sickle blood in your lungs, which is one of the leading causes of fatality in people with sickle cell disease. Most people with sickle cell disease have an average lifespan of about 48 years old, although people are living far beyond that. And in the past couple of years, there have been two new medications specifically for this rare disease. Before that, it had been one medication that was a chemotherapy medication that was found to help improve the symptoms of sickle cell disease. So it had been 20 years before there was even a medication that was focused on managing the symptoms of sickle cell disease.
So, since you said it's a rare condition, do you know offhand about how many people are affected?
Yes, about 100,000 people in the U.S. are affected with sickle cell disease. Majority of those people affected are people of African American descent, although people of Mediterranean descent, Indian, Greek, and Italian, Asian can also be impacted by, Hispanic can also be impacted by sickle cell disease. One in about 16,000 people of Hispanic descent are affected with sickle cell disease as well. So African American, Indian, and Hispanics have the highest prevalence of sickle cell disease in the U.S.
So when you mentioned that it can cause a compromised immune system, with this past year in COVID, I'd imagine that had a huge impact.
Yes, so many people with sickle cell disease, they, of course, stayed in the house. They limited their, before telehealth was instituted kind of nationwide, a lot of patients forewent their routine doctor's appointments for fear of COVID. Because unlike the average person, they would be in that vulnerable population that could succumb to the effects of COVID.
So, in your time with the foundation, has there been any success that stands out for you?
There's a lot of success for some people affected with sickle cell disease with getting a bone marrow transplant, which essentially will kind of cures them of sickle cell. It takes them from having the full-blown sickle cell disease down to the sickle cell trait. So there's been a lot of success with that. And then there's the new advancements with gene therapy. I think there's been a handful of people that have actually been cured through using gene therapies. So there are some great advances on the horizon for the sickle cell community. Unfortunately, still at this time, there is no universal cure for the disease, so not everyone will qualify for bone marrow transplant, and not everyone is a good candidate for gene therapy. So we're still praying and working towards a universal cure so that no person has to suffer forever with this disease. But other than that, the biggest accomplishments so far are the two new medications that came out to specifically manage the symptoms of sickle cell disease in 2019.
So you could see anything added in terms of supports for the sickle cell and rare disease communities, what would it be?
What I can see is a lot of people, even in the rare disease community, they kind of don't realize that sickle cell is still considered a rare disease because a lot of people know about it, but then again, people don't know about it, so it kind of gets left behind. But I do see in the most recent years that the rare disease community is making it a point to become more aware and lend their support to the sickle cell disease community. So I think that perhaps just getting the support nationwide for sickle cell disease is something that we're still working on. It's one of the most underserved diseases out there, and it's one of the most common genetic diseases in the U.S. But however, the support and funding that goes towards sickle cell disease is minimal. There are other rare diseases that affect less people that get more funding. So we don't want to, we're not saying that they shouldn't receive the funding. Any disease should receive the most funding, but we are saying that the sickle cell disease community should, you know, receive, you know, funding that is equitable in measure to, you know, other disease causes. We should be, you know, right there with them.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
In this segment of our show, Maya Brown Zimmerman will be telling us a little bit about her work concerning Marfan syndrome.
So, can you tell me a little bit about the Marfan Foundation?
Yes, the Marfan Foundation serves people with Marfan syndrome and related conditions like Loeys-Dietz syndrome and vascular Ehlers-Danlos syndrome all over the United States. And they have a threefold mission of support, education, and research. So they fund research studies and they help promote other researcher studies. And they provide an annual conference for families. They've got a camp for kids, a social worker and a nurse that are available to answer questions and run support groups, and then provide education to medical professionals.
So for those who might not be as familiar with the syndrome, can you tell me a little about it?
Yes, Marfan syndrome is a potentially life-threatening connective tissue disorder that affects about 1 in every 5 to 10,000 people. It affects the cardiovascular system, the eyes, the lungs, the skeleton, and the nervous system. The biggest risk with Marfan syndrome is an aortic aneurysm, which is a bulge in the aorta, and that can tear, which is life-threatening. And so by knowing the skeletal signs, which can include being tall and thin and double-jointed, people are able to get diagnosed properly and follow the guidelines, and they can have a long and healthy life.
So how do you go about spreading the word about the foundation's work?
Did you ask how we go about spreading the information about the foundation?
Yes.
Yes.
We do a lot of different things. We have walks that we do across the country, which helps spread awareness and raise funds. We do social media campaigns, particularly in February, which is in Marfan Syndrome Awareness Month. And we work with families all over to do local events that they choose. So we have kids who do awareness events at their school, you know, where you can like pay a dollar and wear jeans and they give information about Marfan syndrome. We do stories in the news when something relevant comes up. Like I said, just try to do a lot of local events too and work with medical professionals so that they can let their patients know about us.
So I'd imagine with this past year and COVID, the awareness events would have had to have looked a little different.
Yes. We had to move to a kind of a virtual platform last year, which has its benefits and has its challenges. So on the benefit side, we did a virtual summit last year that lasted 3 weeks in lieu of our annual conference, and then we just had a virtual conference this past weekend, and it was fantastic because people from all over the world could participate. And so we had medical professionals from all over that gave workshops. We offered things in, I think, 8 different languages. And patients who normally wouldn't have access to our annual conference were able to come. So that was really fantastic. The challenge is that it's nice to be able to meet in person for some of these things. And so I'm looking forward to being able to do that next year.
So when you mention medical professionals, do you find there's enough awareness of what Marfan syndrome is and how it affects a person? Do you find doctors are typically aware?
I think that there's a lot more awareness now than there was when I was a kid. So I think that's a testament to the foundation's ability to be able to bring professionals together to educate each other and the foundation's ability to be able to spread the word. I think we still have a long ways to go to make sure that more medical professionals are not just aware of Marfan syndrome, but are knowledgeable about the treatment options and the new standard of care. Because a lot has changed in the past, you know, 15 to 20 years. And so not only do we want doctors to be able to properly diagnose it, but we want them to be able to use the latest treatment options as well.
So, in your time with the foundation, is there any success moment that stands out for you?
think the most exciting thing that's happened was the Sartan versus Atenolol trial. Now, Atenolol is a type of beta blocker, and we've used beta blockers since sometime in the 80s, I think, to lower the blood pressure, which then slows the rate of aortic growth. But we had never done a double-blind trial of that, and we had some researchers that came across the Sartan, which is a different type of blood pressure medication called an angiotensin receptor blocker. And that they had noticed that that had been really successful in mice. And so we were able to test both the Sartan and Atenolol together in a double-blind format and found that at the proper dosing that they're both really effective at reducing the aortic rate of growth. Which puts off surgery or even, you know, prevents the need for surgery for some people. And that was huge, that we had treatment options and that, you know, we had the data to be able to say that they worked. So to me, that was like a life-changing moment. And there are certainly patients that do better with Losartan and that class of medication. You know, beta blockers are contraindicated with asthma, for instance, and so it gave them a great option to be able to use.
So, in what year was the double-blind test?
That was in 2014. And I know that there's research going on now looking at different pathways and different medication options, and so I'm really hopeful that in the next few years that we'll have another medication to be able to trial. In the vascular Ehlers-Danlos community, which is, you know, under our foundation umbrella, they have a drug trial happening right now. And that's the first medication trial for vets that's ever been. And I think that we have more coming from our fan right around the bend here.
So if you could send any message to the community about the need to keep pushing forward with research and awareness, what would you say?
We know that when we have the right tools in place, when we're taking our medication and we're getting monitored, that we're able to do our surgeries preventatively, and that we can have a long and happy life. But the first step of that is awareness. And there are too many people that are finding out that they have one of these conditions when they're in the emergency room having an aortic dissection, or their loved ones are finding out after they've passed away. And so awareness is going to be key to saving lives. And as good as things are now for us, they can be better, which is what we need the research for. And we're really lucky to have a research community that is so passionate about helping us that I think this is a really exciting time. And I'm glad that we have the foundation to kind of spearhead all of this for us.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
So you're hanging with your inner circle. Maybe you're making cocktails. Maybe you're packing bowls. Even while we're distancing, it's important to remember, alcohol and cannabis each mess with your driving skills. Be cool. Make sure you and your friends get home safe. Take a cab if you need to. A few bucks could save a life. And we can do it again next weekend. A message from Arrive Alive, Drive Sober.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Gina Glass told us a little bit about Dreamsicle Kids, Maya Brown Zimmerman told us a little bit about Marfan. In this next segment of our show, we'll hear from Carter Hammett, from Epilepsy Toronto. So, can you tell me a little bit about your work with Epilepsy Toronto?
Sure, absolutely. We are the only employment service dedicated to job search needs of people living with epilepsy in Canada. And as such, we provide a variety of services. We're a small department, we're only two people, but we service the needs of people living in Toronto. And I guess you could say our program is divided into two parts. There's pre-employment and the actual job search. So I am the manager of the department, but I also undertake counseling responsibilities. And within that portfolio, there's intake, there's assessment, there's action planning, goal setting. We try and help people identify realistic job goals and accommodations to go along with them. And once that has been achieved, then we move them into a job search, a development phase, you could call it. And that process involves a placement officer or an employment specialist who assists the job seeker with their resume, their cover letter, their networking, their social media, and ultimately we hope places them or helps them help themselves find work with the additional knowledge that they've achieved going through our process. And we also put a special emphasis on maintaining the job as well. So sometimes people are great at getting jobs, but they're not necessarily good at keeping them. So we put a lot of emphasis on job maintenance too.
So do you find there are any myths or stereotypes out there concerning whether a person with epilepsy can actually attain and retain a job?
Yeah, there are. There's a couple of them. I suppose the greatest, in some respects, the greatest disability is the stigma that surrounds epilepsy. And I think also there's two other components that sort of are part of that. The first is that epilepsy is an invisible condition, so you don't actually see it until it actually happens. And there's a wide variety of myths and misperceptions that are attached to that. A lot of people think that it's what we now call tonic-clonic seizures, and that's all epilepsy is when there's over 40 different conditions, or 40 different types of epilepsy. And then there's the issue, I think, of not wanting to be responsible for the person having those seizures as well. So there's an element of NIMBYism or not in my backyard. We don't want to be responsible if the person injures themselves during a seizure, and we have a certain fear about the unpredictability of when and if and how that person is going to have a seizure as well. So we try to create more knowledge and understanding on the part of employers who are looking to broaden their diversity initiatives by incorporating more people with epilepsy into their workforce, and helping them understand that the great majority of people living with epilepsy can do most jobs.
So, in that sense, how do you go about reaching out to potential employers to take them through some of the benefits?
That's a great question. It's often situational. One of the really nice things I've noticed over the past 6 years that I've been working with epilepsy is that we have been getting more calls from employers asking us, we'd like to hire people with epilepsy, but we're not really quite sure how to manage them or what to do. So that's a positive sign. Some of that has to do with the AODA legislation, but it's also, I think, creating some openings in understanding and awareness of how to incorporate people living with invisible conditions like epilepsy into their workforce. We are part of various committees connected to employers. There are job fairs, there are public events that we host and try to be part of. There's a provincial-wide network called ODIN, the Ontario Network of Employment and Disabilities, and the Ontario Disability Employment Network, and we're part of that. So all of these variables come together to create awareness for employers.
So in your time doing this work, has there been any success moment that stands out for you?
That is a great question. You know, I don't know if there is any one particular moment that really does stand out, but what I can tell you is being able to assist a person finding the strength and the recognition within themselves after going through a hard time and receiving messages, negative messaging, and internalizing that, sometimes they come to us and their self-esteem is battered, they're unsure about what their skills and strengths are, and if we've been able to assist somebody through their journey of being able to understand and articulate what their needs are, and being able to go from the question of, I can't do this job, or however am I going to do this job, to what supports do I need to be successful, and to be able to articulate that, that to me is a success. And I'm proud to say that we've been able to do that several times, and we continue to support people on their journey of self-discovery.
I'd like to thank you for taking time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
I hear it so often, you'd think I'd be less amazed by it by now. The assumptions about disability. The assumption that one type is all types. That all the needs are physical. That every type of condition or need out there is something physical, quantifiable, something our senses can tell us. Now, we are a generation of people who are influenced a lot by what we hear and what our contemporaries think. It's very true. But when it comes to disabilities, we have the right, every one of us, to ask questions, to learn, to grow, be shaped by our own experience with it. But the truth is, disability has struck in every family. And to understand it is to understand a part of ourselves. If you were to pass a dozen people on the street, chances are one of them would have some sort of disability, invisible or otherwise. Fact is, you can't know or assume just based on the obvious. Look beyond the surface. It's not just about disabilities in that sense. How are you ever to get to know people? Any different group in society, if you don't have any first-hand experience, don't take the time to hear their story, to get to know them as people. Do you really want to be in a society so ruled by the idea that we know everything about everything? Whereas I maintain, it's impossible to know everything about anything. If you consider the amazing things and can factor into a person's life. In disability life, that can be a matter of support. The right words at the right time can make a difference between life that counts itself out or the person who sees their own strength and value. It can be a matter of knowing about the right treatment or being denied access to that information. But people are more than meets the eye. And we should have the innate curiosity to understand people before we make up our minds as to who they are and what makes them tick. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.